Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio.
Evenings at 6:30 on Faith Radio.
And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. I'm very excited about my hour ahead, and I'm hoping that you are too. Thank you for joining me today as you invite me into whatever space you have. It's your car or your house. I'm honored to be part of your day. So thank you very much. And I was reading in Proverbs 29, verse 23, it says, "One's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor." Of course, it made me think of the first beatitude in Matthew chapter 5, verse 3. It says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I think a lot of people, maybe most people, think that being poor in the spirit has something to do with being shy or withdrawn. But the verse in Proverbs helps show that poor in spirit is like lowly in spirit, which is the opposite of being filled with pride. Rather, poor in spirit just means humble. So, and the Bible is filled with passages about being humble. I think in Luke 14, 7 through 14, it talks about the parable of the lower seat or parable of the wedding feast. It advises you not to sit at the best seat. You might be asked to move down and be ashamed, but rather sit at a lower seat and you may be asked to move up higher. So the conclusion, I think, in all of this is, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. So the first beatitude is just about being humble. So I'm always humbled by the fact that I come on the radio and you invite me in. I just got to let you know that is a humbling experience. So thank you for listening to my show, and thank you for supporting Faith Radio. As you know, my friend David Wheaton is a regular weekly contributor, and I can hardly wait every week to have him on the show. So let me take a short break, and we'll have him back on in 60 seconds.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way, you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
My friend David Wheaton is an author, a radio host, speaker, and, of course, I first met him when he had a tennis racket in his hand when he was 4 years old, and he was good then. And he's the author of two books, University of Destruction, Your Game Plan for Spiritual Victory on Campus, and My Boy Ben, A Story of Love, Loss, and Grace. You go to thechristianworldview.org to learn more about David. He's a weekly radio host and a regular guest on my show. David, welcome. Hi, David. We're close to getting them. See, I'm prepared for things like this as a radio professional. This doesn't faze me in the least. There you go. You there, David? All right. We'll try to connect with David. We're going to talk to David today about the Mueller report when he gets available to us, and what that says about our country's worldview. We are certainly at a very interesting place in our country, the way we are consuming news and processing it, and when we just spent 2 years waiting for this report to come out, the various ways in which we as a country have processed it and decided about how it has affected us and our country. So I love this passage in Exodus 23, verse 1. It says, "You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness." We're going to talk about this from a spiritual standpoint. We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll try to get David on the line. Welcome back to the show. It's 11 minutes after the hour. And it's interesting, I was chatting about humility. You always get handed a little dose of humility when you have technical glitches. And I was thinking of the third beatitude, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. You know, sometimes we often think about being meek or being cowardly, but that's not it. We're going to talk about truth today and about standing up for truth and not bearing false witness. David Wheaton is my guest on our studio line. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Bill. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
This, Skype dropped immediately when you were introducing to me, so I apologize.
That's A-okay. Now, I want to chat. I was telling our listeners we're going to chat about the Mueller report and really what it says, the results say about the way we're our country's worldview.
Yeah, you know, this has been the most major news story of the last 2 years. And that's really saying a lot. The most major news story, at least in our country, the last 2 years has been the Robert Mueller-led investigation as to whether Donald Trump colluded with the Russian government to win the 2016 presidential election. I mean, that's a pretty big allegation if
it's
you
huge.
Think about it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's like impeachment, you're out of office, treason, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, out of the White House in handcuffs, maybe, they talked about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's just a major, major allegation. So I just want to read a paragraph from a website called Axios that did a report on this. It said, after nearly 2 years, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, listen to this, netted 199 criminal charges, 37 indictments or guilty pleas, and 5 prison sentences. It also cost, it's estimated to have cost $34 million.
Oh, wow.
So they had something like, they had 40 FBI agents working for him, 19 lawyers, and tons of other staff investigating whether the president colluded again with the Russian government. So here's the end of it now. After reviewing the report, Attorney General William Barr sent a summary to Congress saying the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. Just think about that.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 years and that much money and that number of people, this allegation that was brought against the president turned out not to be true. You can see the power of false allegation. I know you have a soundbite that just is kind of a montage of the media during this time, some of the mainstream media, including some of the cable channels, basically breathlessly and incessantly every night talking about Trump colluded. Maybe you just want to play 30, 45 seconds
sure.
of that just to give the audience an idea of what it was like in case they weren't watching some of the news reports.
Okay.
Does the public understand just how much trouble the president is in?
To believe that the president isn't compromised requires such a leap of faith.
I think we have all the proof we need of a scandal that's arguably worse than Watergate.
Do we know if there is still this belief and aspect
right.
that the president is working for the Russians? I can't answer that.
The U.S. president possibly working for the Russians.
There you go.
And it just goes on for another minute after
mm-hmm.
that. Now, this was just a montage of all the reporting. If you watched it, it was really, and again, just to qualify here, this isn't about affirming Donald Trump as a person or as a Republican, nothing to do with that. It's really more about discussing the power of false accusation and what the Democrat leadership, the lengths they went to, and joined in by, as we just heard, the media. The real collusion here to remove the president was between the Democrat leadership and the media. It turns out not between President Trump and the Russian government. And it really goes to the point of what it says in the book of Exodus. You shall not bear a false report. Okay, don't lie. Don't make false allegation. And the second half of the verse says, do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. And I think that summarizes what's going on here. We had malicious people or false reports being born against the president, no basis in fact. Then you had the media as kind of a willing accomplice to try to go along with the false report. That's a bad situation, and it says something very, very rotten about the American political system and media right now.
It sure does. So what do you think some of the collateral damage is going to be as a result of the investigation of our country at this level?
Well, you know, people have always, I think, lacked confidence in political leadership. But when you have an investigation like this that lasts 2 years and with this many people investigating the president, it turns out, oh, whoops, there was really nothing there that shows collusion, what we were looking for. I think it just erodes the confidence of our citizenry in the media and our political leaders. And these lies, what turned out to be a lie that was repeated night after night after night, they become embedded in especially the younger generation starts to, you know, the lie is that's what Satan's known as. He's the false accuser. He's a liar. Lies are powerful. When we sin, every time we sin, we believe a lie and act on a lie. And so when these lies become embedded in the younger generation, then it turns out, well, we don't believe this report. No, he was colluding. You know, in other words, it just further divides people because some people aren't going to believe this report that he didn't collude with the Russian government, and they're going to hold on to that, and it's going to further divide people. And then when that side gets in power, there's greater payback to try to vindicate themselves as being right in the first place. So I don't think the ramifications are good. I think it erodes the unity of this country, and I think it's a very bad thing.
Mm-hmm. David, let me take a little break. David Wheaton is my guest. He is the host of The Christian Worldview. You can go to thechristianworldview.org to learn more about David and hear some of his podcasts. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll continue on with David in just a minute. David Wheaton is my guest, my regular guest, and he is at the ChristianWorldview.org is his website. We're talking about the Mueller report, what it says about our country and our country's worldview. It seems to be an incredible worldwide divide in America now, David. What do you make of that, and how does that impact the evangelical church?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question because, you know, I think people who are paying attention to what's going on in our society feel this huge divide. It's a worldview divide. In our culture now. That's what it comes down to. People see the same issue and come at it from completely opposite perspectives. You know, some people see, I heard one of the candidates for governor or senator in Georgia called the law that was just made down in Georgia to not allow abortions after a heartbeat is detected. She called it evil. Okay, that's evil, an evil law. And yet, on the other side, you have people who are pro-life who would think, well, it's completely evil to take the life of a viable unborn child. So that just illustrates, you know, where we are as a country. And it's not just one person who believes that's evil to have a law like that. It's a whole raft of people now. It's a significant voting block. It's the division between the political parties in this country. And it's wide. It's become wider. And I think to answer the question why that is, well, I think the culture, the broader society has been so impacted by the humanistic worldview that takes place in the educational system and particularly in higher education in the universities. So the radicalism that was there, the leftism that was there, preaching, evangelizing, to use a Christian term, more that humanistic worldview, the socialistic worldview, communitarian, globalistic, that kind of worldview has taken root so strongly in a big part of our population now, but there's still some in our society who still hold to a worldview more based on a traditional American, nationalistic, largely generally Christian worldview. So if it's not, that hasn't changed much that has changed a lot in the culture, but also in the church as well. There's been a huge impact of what's been taking place in the culture moving into the church into theological liberalism. And so when you combine those two things, just regular leftism and then theological leftism, you have a lot of people's minds looking at issues now very, very differently than they did at a different time in America. There's an undermining bill. There's a loss of confidence in the biblical worldview. You hear what political leaders are saying now in the campaign trial. Just the other day, Joe Biden acted like all sins of our past come from people because they're white and they're Christians. So whether it's slavery, the oppression of women, the oppression of homosexuals, economic inequalities, the imperialistic nature, this is all because of the influence of Christianity and white men on a society, and that needs to be diminished. When you've lost confidence in what the country – now, there were sins of the past, but that's in spite of a biblical worldview, not because of it. And it's like no society, other society, ever has any sins that are actually equal to or far worse than the ones that we've suffered through in the past, our history. When you lose confidence in your history like that, your country's in very big trouble.
Yeah. So, David, what are some of the things that, what are some of the byproducts of this division? I mean, what can we learn from this? How do we as Christians and followers of Christ check our own biases and judgments that we don't race to conclusions?
I mean, two things I'd say to that. Number one is Christians need to realize the power of false accusation here, and we need to make sure we're never part of that, not jumping to conclusions before we know the evidence. Look at the greatest example of false accusation in the history of mankind was Jesus Christ, right?
Mm-hmm.
It says in Matthew 26, now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so they might put him to death. They did not find any,
right,
even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two false witnesses came forward and said, this man stated I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. In other words, I'm not comparing Trump to Jesus. That's not the point. Again, the point is the power of false accusation is that it's so powerful that it led to the crucifying of the creator of the universe. So as Christians, we need to be so careful that we don't jump to conclusions without really knowing solid evidence. Because when we falsely or join in with false accusation against someone else, we are really most like Satan, who is called the accuser of the brethren, right? In Proverbs 6, another great example of this, there are six things the Lord hates, yet seven are an abomination to him. Seven things the Lord hates, the famous seven. Interestingly, two of the seven have to do with lying and being a false witness. This is the thing, again, that sets us apart from God and makes us most like Satan when we partake in false accusations. So I think that's the first thing that Christians need to be so careful of not being involved in lies and false accusations. And number two, this is a lesson for the church as well, not to be impacted by what's going on in the culture. It's this influence of, I would say, socialism is a word that's bantered around a bit, but let's say just the liberalism of this side that made this false accusation. They're very, very good at using Christian language in terms of justice and mercy and love and using Christian-sounding language to bring that type of worldview into the church. It's called liberation theology, theological liberalism. It's very dangerous for the church because this is what's happened to the mainstream denominations in this country. They're basically no different than kind of liberal political organizations now. The gospel's been lost. There's no bold and biblical preaching in those churches anymore. And the evangelical church has to be wary and be discerning for what types of influences are coming upon the church.
Mm-hmm. So, David, is the media think they're going to let up on this report that Mueller has come out with that said, look, there's no collusion? Are they going to put it to rest, or is the fight just begun?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict, but from what I've seen so far, I think there was some new news today, which I haven't totally tuned into yet, but it seemed like after the announcement came out, there were some objections. Well, we want to see the whole report. You know, we don't want to have the Attorney General tell us what was in it. We want to read it for ourselves, which is understandable, but can you imagine what you'd be finding out about all the people they investigate? They don't want to ruin people's lives, basically, if there's no collusion. That's why
right.
they believe they didn't let it out. But it looks like, well, we're going to pivot now to something else. Now, that 2 years and $34 million and five prison sentences is over, let's just move on to the next point. So in some ways, it's just the way, unfortunately, our fallen nature is. Like, let's bring out the false accusation. Let's throw it against the wall. If it doesn't stick, we'll move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not good at predicting the future, so who knows?
Yeah. Well, remind us how to set our hearts to look for truth and to seek truth and love and not, you know, even when it challenges some of our preconceptions.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly the great concluding point, Bill, is that this is why, as Christians, we need to be being washed on a daily basis, because we, too, are not above being influenced by the lies of the Satan and lies of the culture. And so we need to be daily washed in the Word by taking in the Word ourselves or by hearing sound preaching of the Word by those who exposit the Word correctly and biblically, who accurately handle the word of truth, as Paul told to Timothy, because when we do that, that's a barrier, that's a boundary, that's a protective barrier from being influenced by the lies that just fly around all the time. So if you don't want to be impacted by the worldview of the culture and the false accusations, the allegations, the lies, and the distortions and so forth. And they're tricky to discern, even within the church when they have Christian-sounding language. You must be washed and being transformed by the Word on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. David, we just got about a minute left. You live on a lake. Is there much ice left?
It is looking really soft, and the edges are starting to melt. And when that happens, it's probably not too far away, especially if we get some warm weather and rain.
Yeah, that's going to make a big difference, isn't it?
I'm happy for spring.
Looking
forward to it.
You and me both. David, thanks so much for doing the show. I look forward to our conversation next week.
Always enjoy it, Bill.
Thanks,
you.
David Wheaton's been my guest. And, of course, go to thechristianworldview.org to learn more about David. And you can see all of his podcasts and listen to him and his brilliant interview style and his great guests, many of which I wouldn't mind having on the show myself. We'll take a little break and be back with Jim Burns. Welcome back to the show. I've got Jim Burns on my studio line. He's the author and president of Homeward. He lives in Southern California. There's lots to not like about him already. Jim, how are you?
I am good. Yeah. I actually stocked you with triple espresso, so this is a treat for me.
That's hysterical. So, very interesting book, Doing Life with Your Adult Children. What if your adult children don't speak to you?
You'd be amazed how many times I hear that, Bill.
Oh, I'm serious. I figured you hear it a lot. That's kind of
you hear
a tough
it all the
one.
Time.
Yeah.
No, you do. What I often say is so what's the issue, and how can you reconcile that? And oftentimes it's if the issue is something really tough, you don't reconcile it by having a big sit down talk and being a one topic parent, but you actually just start building that relationship again. You remember them on their birthdays. You care for the grandkids if they had kids. You mm-hmm. do whatever you can to mend that relationship and realize you're running a marathon, not a sprint. So it might take years.
Yeah.
But you do it anyway.
Yeah. So how tricky is it to do life with your adult kids?
Well, it's hard because, when your kids become adults, and I put question, on radio, you can't put quotation marks, but,
right.
I'm doing that as I'm talking.
Doing
with
air quotes.
But, yeah, because some of them say they're adults, and I'm not sure they are acting
right.
like it. At least that was our three kids, and yet they were great kids. But, I didn't know how to do that. I'd invested two decades of my life. My wife had invested two decades of her life being the parent day to day, and we needed to be fired. And fired from day to day and change it from an adult kid to an adult relationship. And that wasn't easy for us. And we found out it wasn't easy for our kids either because, it was the first time they were doing it too.
So parents, obviously, when they pour their lives for a couple of decades into their kids, they must be pretty darn tired at the end of the day. I think you talk about how important it is for self-care for parents. Would you say more about that?
Yeah. Well, what I find, Bill, is that when I speak on this subject, and now that this book has just come out in the last week, but as people are getting back to us, they're tired, they're worn out, and they're surprised that their kids who were raised even with faith and values kind of violated the values and sometimes stray from the faith. And so they are tired. One of the things I say is you've got to get as spiritually and emotionally healthy as you possibly can because, you're in it for the long haul, and there could be some bumps and bruises along the way, and so get healthy. And a lot of times that when kids are, especially in those teen years, it's not easier. Sometimes you're even hurting in your marriage if you're married because you're focusing on those teens and you're not focusing on the marriage, your child-focused marriage. And all of a sudden you look up and you go, wow, we haven't taken care of ourselves. And, I think that's the mistake a lot of us make. And so we're depleted. And so we've got to tend that fire within our own soul as well. As keep the relationship burning with our adult kids.
So, Jim, I don't mean to get so practical applications so early in the interview, but what are some things that parents can do for themselves while they're trying to manage the stress of life with their adult kids?
Well, one of the things, Bill, is I keep finding, these people whose kids are, crashing and burning or not you know, living how they thought they were going to live, and they feel shame, and they are doing it alone because they think, wait, we raised our kids in the church, and we gave them these values, and we paid for these extra special things, and they're in youth group, and now they're not doing so well. And I think you need to have replenishing relationships. And I have found that the families who and the parents who spend time with others, kind of sharing and, you know, saying, I know that this sounds terrible, but here's our situation. The other thing that they find out in that is that really good parents have kids who make some poor choices. So I think the replenishing relationship thing is very, very key. And I also think that you can't be a one-topic parent if the kids violated values. So, you know, I had a situation this last weekend. I was suffering speaking in Honolulu, Hawaii, of all places.
Oh, poor baby.
And a woman comes up to me. Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel your pain. But, you know, this woman came up to me, and her daughter was smoking pot and living with her boyfriend. And she's still in college, and it's not going so well. And she says, every time I talk to her about this, and it's just not working. I said, does she know how you feel? Yes. Does she know what you believe? Yes. Okay. What does she like to do? She likes to shop and eat. Take her shopping and eat, and don't bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is there's more than just one topic. And yet, you know, that woman's heart was breaking, and I totally get that. But when our heart is breaking, that's when we probably need to talk with somebody else and not just focus and be that one-topic parent. And sometimes parents will even express their anger and their disappointment over and over and over again. And even when kids are violating values, the one thing they want to know, Bill, is, do you still love me? And they don't see love when we're just, you know, always either giving them advice or telling them, you know, what we think. One of the chapters in the book says, unsolicited advice is usually taken as criticism. So when they're adults, I think you almost ask for permission to give advice, and eventually mm-hmm. they come around. I mean, I see this with my kids right now. You know, I've moved from the day-to-day parent to kind of a more of a mentor coach. And, you know, I had two of the three of my kids today already call me and ask me some questions. And I was like, wow,
that's cool.
You know, things are good. That's amazing because, you know, they weren't asking that question a few years ago. They're in their early 30s. So, you know, I've kind of gotten through some of the what I would call tougher times because, again, Kathy and I didn't know how to do this. We weren't keeping our mouth shut. We were saying what we thought, and they were taking it as criticism.
Yeah. Dad, what's that PIN number again for the ATM card?
Exactly.
It wasn't questions like that, was it?
That's the other thing that parents can't do. You know, they got to help their kids become responsible adults, and part of that is responsible finances. And, you know, I kind of laugh because 75% of parents of adult children do, you know, put some money into the system often. And sometimes the best thing you can do, even if you had the money, was say no,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they've got to become responsible adults. One of my daughters lives in New York, and she has a good friend who is in the top 30, the 30 under 30 Forbes.
Wow. She's a hitter.
Incredible people.
Yeah.
But the story is that her parents have a lot of money. They live in Houston, and they pay for everything. So when my daughter, who didn't have a lot of money, I said, how are you having all these amazing sushi dinners? And she goes, oh, you know, so-and-so pays for it. And I said, well, how does she pay for it? Because she doesn't have a job, does she? She goes, well, actually, it's her parents' credit card.
Wow.
But she made the top 30, you know, under 30. And I'm thinking, well, I think her parents kind of made the top 30 under 30.
Yeah, there's a little disconnect there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when finally she becomes, you know, this kid who's going to have to be responsible, if that ever happens, you know, she's going to have to go through some tougher times because she's really, her parents are enabling her and helping her to become an entitled kid and not really launching. So there's a failure to launch because, you know, they're paying for it. And yet mm-hmm. she's a pretty talented kid, obviously, but she just, you know, probably needs to get out a little bit on her own and probably not have as many fine sushi dinners.
Yeah. Jim, what happens with adult children when kids come into the picture and all of a sudden now they're the power broker because they get to decide when the kids can see grandma and grandpa and, you know, where they are going to be on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day and all that stuff?
Yeah. Well, those are the kind of conversations that I think you want to have very delicately, especially when it comes to, like you just mentioned, the holidays. You know what our family did is we celebrate Thanksgiving, but we don't with the family celebrate it on that Thursday. We actually celebrate it before. And so then it takes all the pressure off of our kids. Two of our kids are married.
Sure.
It takes the pressure off of them if they want to be with their in-laws. And that's you know, the fine way. Sometimes I tell a story in the book about a woman who was so close to her son. Her son marries a daughter-in-law that she didn't really love. Well, she loves the daughter-in-law, I would imagine, but didn't like her necessarily. And she was getting, you know, blocked by the daughter-in-law And I say in the book, I say, you know, the way to your son and your grandkids is through your daughter-in-law. And so she stopped by one day, gave her a Starbucks card, moved on. Another, she loved the, you know, the young woman loved coffee. Next week, she brings another Starbucks card. Finally, the woman says, hey, let's go to Starbucks and, you know, start creating this relationship. And long story short, they're now kind of BFFs, and she has total access to her grandkids, and, you know, her son is happy too because they're spending more time. So sometimes you just really have to invest in the in-law, and you know, sometimes that's complicated, but that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you write as enjoyably as you speak? Because you're such an absolute delight on the interview. You know, so if your style translates into this book, I'm going to run out and buy 3 copies tonight.
Hey, I'm telling you, I wanted the book to be kind of fun, yep, and enjoyable to read at the same time. For one thing, when I talk with people who have adult children, so many of them are really down. I just am shocked that they violated values and they did all this. So I wanted to give them hope, and I think you give people hope from when you give them some practical advice. But at the same time, and you know this well, because you know, you don't know me, but I know of what you do. You know, humor is something that can break down depression. It can break down issues, and so why not, you know, bring some humor into the world? And so, you know, most every chapter has something that's, at least I think, is funny. I mean, yeah, you're a comedian. I'm not.
Which I don't
say something funny.
Yeah.
And my wife will sometimes go, yeah, that wasn't as funny as you thought it was. She laughed harder than the crowd, but, you know.
I'm going to send your wife a gift card.
You did it for a living.
Yeah. Let's talk about, because I love this. The subtitle makes me smile, which is Keep Your Mouth Shut and Welcome Matt Out. I'd love for you to talk more about that and how those qualities work together.
Well, it kind of describes the whole book, you know, that subtitle, because again, as parents, we've been giving advice for all these years. And really, I think the way we respect our kids is to, you know, keep our mouth shut. And to do that, I've had to, you know, bite my tongue. You know, one of the things that I like to say is, you know, why does she need to go to Europe to find herself when I have all the answers for her right now, you know, and I do,
mm-hmm,
but you know, they don't want to hear it. So I think sometimes we have to truly, you know, respect them by not being intrusive and, you know, asking for permission for advice. I had a funny experience with my daughter, Christy. She's our oldest, and she and her wonderful husband, Steve, and our 2 grandkids did a horrible thing. They moved to Texas from California for 1 year. She's coming back, but, you know, we were just saddened. They were living with us to save some money for 2 months, and they were having a intense discussion about the move. Were they going to use a U-Haul? Were they going to do a trailer? What were they going to do? And so, you know, innocently, I thought I had the answer. So I walked into the conversation in our living room and said, hey, I've got a better idea than both of you. And Christy looked at me and she goes, not now, Dad, not now, as she's in this conversation. So I just bit my tongue. About a week later, Christy said, hey, they'd already made a horrible decision, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
And Christy goes, hey, what were you going to tell us? And I said, oh, I thought it was, you know, here's what you do. And she goes, well, Dad, why didn't you interrupt me and tell me that? That's the best idea. Too late.
Oh, so that's funny, Jim.
What I find is that still what I had to do was, you know, kind of respect her wishes. And, you know, I wanted to say, wait a minute, I get paid for giving people advice. What are you thinking? But anyway, that didn't work with my kids.
Yeah.
So I honestly think it's honoring kids to do that. And it also helps you become a mentor and a coach, you know, because you're moving from, you know, kind of a control in a parent, not all control, obviously, when they're teens either. But, you know, you really do move to, you know, kind of being more of a mentor and a coach. And it's kind of like that, the Field of Dreams movie. If you build it, they will come. It was talking about baseball diamond. But I think if you kind of keep your mouth shut and respect them, keep the welcome mat out, they will come back.
Yeah. Fantastic wisdom there, Jim. Jim Burns is my guest. He's the author and president of Homeward, and his book is Doing Life with Your Adult Children. We're going to take a little break, but when I come back, I want to ask him about many adult kids. They're being described as emerging adults. Adults, there's air quotes around emerging. All right, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back. The big hand is on the 46, which means that's, do the math, carry the one. There's 14 minutes until the top of the hour. Jim Burns is my guest. He's the author and president of Homeward, The book that he wrote we're chatting about is Doing Life with Your Adult Children. Jim, you say that many adult children are calling them emerging adults. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, that was not a word when I did my little PhD work in England. In fact, you know, what I learned was, you know, you had children, you had adolescents, which was fairly new, you had adults, and then you had elderly. But today, there's a new whole segment called emerging adults. And emerging adults are people who are in their 20s, typically probably about 18 when people say that they're, when these kids say that they're adults. And you kind of emerge into adulthood. For example, I got married right out of college, which was kind of the norm for guys like me. And today, the average marriage age is 29 for men and 27, 28 for women. So, you know, they're meandering toward responsibility, or they're meandering toward marriage. Mm-hmm. And so part of doing life with your adult children is understanding that they are millennials, and actually even some of the youngest are now Gen Z. And there's some real distinctives that these kids have that their parents sometimes don't understand. And it's basic things like, you know, they're being shaped by technology. They're a generation who does want a healthy marriage, but they're going to, like I said, you know, do it much slowly. And sometimes parents can't understand that. And that's part of the emerging side. And then, one of the other real big distinctives is that they view tolerance as one of the major traits of a loving person. And so parents are aghast at what they believe, or what they're frustrated their parents believe. And it may even have to do with a biblical worldview. So, you know, what I'm saying to parents is become students of the culture. And parents are saying, well, why is this, you know, taking this kid so long? And what I have to say is a prayer that I pray, Lord, you know, teach me to parent the children I have and not the child I was or the children that I thought, you know, I was going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, I think that's really, really critical. But it's a real age of identity exploration, frankly, an age of instability. Many, many years ago, you have a very good friend named Bob Stromberg, and I spent a lot of time in the what we call the youth specialties world. You were there too.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking more about teenagers, and I would talk about the same thing, some, you know, major identity, some instability, experimental phase. Well, that's still happening in teens, but now it's happening to even a greater extent in this what we call emerging adults. So, you know, they're going to make it. They're going to do okay. But parents are like, what on earth happened here? And sometimes even with that, they experience what I call in the book the cringe factor, meaning that there's kind of a moral free fall that we're seeing in our country. And you know, it's getting picked up with, you know, pornography, escalation, cohabitation, gender identity confusion, faith, you know, straying from faith, you know, et cetera. And parents are coming to counselors saying, who is this kid? And, you know, what did I do wrong? When in fact, you can't blame it all on being an emerging adult, but you can say that it's a distinctive of the culture.
So, Jim, what's you call the messy middle? What is that? And how do we love our kids and try to maintain a really strong, positive relationship when we don't agree or approve of their choices?
Yeah. Well, I think you can still be in what you're right. I call it the messy middle. What that means is you love your kids no matter what. And at the same time, it's not like you have to change your belief system. So is it possible? And I think it is. I'm not sure this happens in our political system, but I think you see it in families, in good families. It's very possible to show love, care, and let them know that they're loved, and yet at the same time, let them know how you feel in terms of a belief system or whatever it might be. And the messy middle says you're in the middle of that, meaning you're going to show love and you're at the same time going to still, you know, stick strong to some of your values. But showing love does not mean that you accept everything that they do. And I think a lot of parents think, well, I have to do a tough love. And that means that they think they need to be mean. I don't think that brings anybody around. I think what you've got to do is say, you know, we're going to agree to disagree, but wow, let's go shopping. Let's go get something to eat. Let's go to a ball game. You know, let's go hang out. Because there's a lot of people who we spend time with in our work or in our extended family or whatever that we're not going to agree with, but we're still going to do life with them. And what I'm afraid is parents are so upset about some of these changes that they're not willing to be in the messy middle and, you know, feel – so what they do is they kind of – I don't think the word is disown their kids, but they just kind of quit spending time with them. And, you know, I think it's very, very possible, Bill, to be in that messy middle. And a lot of times I find kids will you know, they'll believe something or they'll be acting like something. And by the time they get a little older, you know, they come back around. We're seeing this in faith right now. Kids are, you know, just leaving the faith like crazy at about 16, 17. But we are seeing many of them come back once they get married, once they have their own children. And, you know, that's a good sign. So, you know, we got to celebrate some of that. But as a parent, if you're a parent when they're straying and you're dealing with this stuff, it's, you know, it's really, really hard.
Yeah,
and
Jim,
then we want to – oh, go ahead.
Do you, Jim, do you have an example of tough love? Because I keep – sometimes when I hear tough love, I would like to see what it looks like. Is there a sliding scale? What is maybe an example of what tough love would look like?
Well, I'll tell you an example of somebody that I really appreciate, and I think they're incredible. And again, it's back to not confusing tough love with meanness.
Mm-hmm.
So they're saying, I love you, I don't agree with you. But the tough love said their daughter got a DUI, and they could pay for the, you know, top DUI attorney of, you know, their city. And they could, I'm sure they could have got this daughter out of this. And the tough love was, they said, oh, we love you, we're sorry, there are some consequences here. And, you know, that daughter had the DUI on her record for 10 years.
Wow.
And, you know, that's going to affect a lot of different things, one being insurance. But the parents, you know, let her live with those consequences. So it's allowing the consequences, you know, not bailing them out, I guess. And so I like that illustration because the illustration is they stayed right with her. They loved on her. They drove her to the DUI school or whatever. She was just mortified. You know, it's a neat Christian family. She had an open bottle in her, mm-hmm. in her car at college and, you know, sorority, whatever. But, you know, I love the fact that they didn't bail her out. They didn't dump their anger and frustration on her. And so at the same time, they had to find some support for them. We're friends with these people. So, you know, they came to us and said, I can't believe what just was going on. And I just affirmed them. At the same time, it was back to what I said. The, you know, the big story for the daughter was, I've shamed you. I've shamed the family. And, you know, she probably thought that because of who this family was. But do you still love me? And they still showed love. So, that, you know, it wasn't like they removed love. They just let the consequences bear out. So a lot of times what we – it's kind of like I use this word, you earned it. Okay, that's a recovery word. But, mm-hmm. you know, so if the kids made a poor choice, well, you earned it. And I think part of showing tough love is you can't want it more than they want it. And we do as parents. And we just can't want it more than they want it. So we've got to figure out how to show them love in the midst of them making some silly choices and allowing them to have those consequences.
Right, Jim, aren't we almost doing kids a disservice if we don't allow them to suffer consequences? I mean, you hear stories of someone drops their phone in the lake and hours later they have a new phone, even when they were told not to take their phone out onto the water. Or they have a car and they have an accident and it's totaled and they're maybe distracted driving. And all of a sudden the next day they have another different car, maybe not a new one, but there's nothing that serves as a natural consequence of their behavior if you're always racing to the rescue.
Exactly. That's called entitlement. And so what we're doing is we have a group of parents today who, and we have to be very careful that we're not just, you know, helping our kids become entitled who will have a failure to launch, and they're not going to become responsible adults because they, you know, dropped their phone and then we paid for it. Drop mm-hmm. your phone. There's a consequence to it. Figure out how to buy another phone.
Right.
And you don't have to be mean about it. You can just say, oh, I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do to help you find the money? You know, do you need some extra work or, you know, whatever to find the money to get it? But, you know, they'll learn that you don't take it out on the lake.
Right. And there was a generation not that long ago when, you know, 16 and a half year olds would be lying that they were 18 so they could join the Navy.
Right. Right.
So exactly. You write about your mom and how much people loved her, especially young people. What was her secret?
Well, it was actually her tone. She just set a tone of warmth. She was very welcoming. She was very, and she loved everybody. Oh my gosh.
Okay.
And so people were drawn to her. I mean, I can remember when I was in high school, somebody would knock on the door. Is Jim here? No, he's down at the gym playing basketball. Can I just come in and hang out with you? Well, with her. And so then they'd hang out with my mom. She'd feed him cookies and all the fun stuff.
Right.
But what I'm trying to say here is that warmth and setting a tone of warmth and love and acceptance. And my mom didn't agree with everybody who wandered into her presence in terms of how they live life, including my brothers, I think. But she still showed that warmth. That's a discipline, Bill. It's not just you know, that she's optimistic. It was truly a discipline. She disciplined herself to sometimes just say this phrase, does it really matter? And some things matter. And when things mattered, I felt like my mom was really healthy about letting us know what she thought. But most things didn't matter. Mm-hmm. So she, you know, she allowed us to be ourselves, and she also brought warmth even when she disagreed with us. But, you know, I've had to do that. I walk out, and I do this in my marriage. I do this with my relationship with my kids. You know, does it really matter? No, I don't really think that matters.
Yeah.
Some things, that really matters. But most, frankly, it doesn't matter in terms of, you know, coming on, you know, so headstrong, and, you know, we get too serious about it.
Yeah, we're in the final minute or so, Jim. Parents that have kids, adult kids at home, do you have any specific advice for them?
Yeah. Well, we call them the boomerang parents, and our boomerang kids, I mean. And what I think you do is I think you set up boundaries and express some expectations about being at home. So what we did when our daughter Becca came home after college, and she said she was going to go into grad school, so could she come our way and, you know, get some free room and board, and that was great for us. But we also handed her a scrub brush. We handed her some responsibilities. Mm-hmm. We said we wanted her – if she was going to be our roommate, we wanted her to be around two nights for dinner. And she had to participate in certain things. It wasn't just the Burns Hotel. And you know what? I think Becky even appreciated that. I mean, we didn't put too much on her, but we said we want a relationship with you in a different way. And also we want the toilet cleaned. And before that, we were cleaning your toilet, but
right.
Now that you're back, you're on.
Jim, what a delight. Jim Burns has been my guest. His book is called Doing Life with Your Adult Children. Subtitle is Keep Your Mouth Shut and the Welcome Mat Out. Jim, really nice to talk to you and connect with you again.
Great to talk with you.
Yeah,
and again, we used to stalk you at we probably went five times in San Diego. So
nice.
We were those people.
Ah, those people. Well, have a great night and blessings to your family.
Yes.
Yep, thanks
okay,
so much.
You too.
Yep,
take care.
That
all
wraps
right.
up our show for the day. Thanks to all my wonderful guests who made the show so wonderful. And just remember, as you lay your head on that pillow tonight, God is writing his great grand story in your life. Good night. God bless. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.